is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation. Trump's first year with Simon Marks.
Hello from Washington. I'm Simon Marks, and I hope you're enjoying what the Americans always call happy holidays. Welcome to our special two-hour broadcast here on LBC. We're looking back at a roller coaster year in America because whatever you think of the US president, whether you love him or loathe him, that is exactly what it has been. Living in the US, covering President Trump for LBC during 2017 has been a year-long ride of unpredictability with all sorts of highs and lows, twists and turns, jolts and bumps, and constant reminders that you never ever know what lies right around the corner. It all began, of course, on January the 21st at high noon. A new sheriff officially arrived in town.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States. But
while the swearing-in followed time-honored tradition, the new president's inaugural address did not. Flanked by his predecessors in the White House, Barack Obama, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and Jimmy Carter, and by his vanquished and devastated opponent, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump dumped on them all. He accused America's political elites of reducing the country to rubble.
Mothers and children trapped in poverty in our inner cities, rusted out factories scattered like tombstones across the landscape, and the crime, and the gangs, and the drugs that have stolen too many lives and robbed our country of so much unrealized potential. This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
Ian Dale, watching alongside me in our Washington studios, didn't fancy it at all.
What I heard there was the most divisive speech I've ever heard from a president of the United States at an inauguration ceremony. I thought large parts of it were a disgrace. Large parts of it could have been delivered by Benito Mussolini.
And George W. Bush apparently agreed, telling friends afterwards that was some weird stuff. Except he didn't use the word stuff. It was a brave woman then who decided to be the first foreign leader to set foot in Donald Trump's White House.
Today's talks, I think, are a significant moment for President Trump and I to build our relationship, and I look forward to continuing to work with you.
You know, it's interesting because I am a people person. I think you are also, Teresa. And I can often tell how I get along with somebody very early, and I believe we're going to have a fantastic relationship.
That didn't stand the test of time, and it wasn't the most recent tensions over the president's retweets of racist videos by Britain First that were the first wrinkle in the relationship. That came while Theresa May was still in American airspace. No sooner had she left the White House than President Trump, with a flourish of his executive pen, was closing America's borders to citizens from seven mainly Muslim countries.
I'm establishing new vetting measures to keep radical Islamic terrorists out of the United States of America. We don't want them here. We only want to admit those into our country who will support our country and love deeply our people.
And so chaos ensued on what was only the second weekend of the Trump presidency. As immigration officials implemented the president's orders, protesters swamped America's airports. We brought you live coverage on Matt Stadland's overnight program.
We can now go across to Washington and LBC's US correspondent Simon Marks.
The resistance to this is beginning to grow. We're witnessing protests at major airports all over the United States. But as you know, Donald Trump is absolutely standing by what he's done. He says it's working out very nicely. And this, of course, is exactly what he said he was going to do.
In London, the Prime Minister, who just days earlier had walked hand in hand through the White House grounds with the president and invited him to make a state visit to the UK, suddenly distanced herself from him.
This government is clear that that policy is wrong. We wouldn't do it. In 6 years as Home Secretary, I never introduced such a policy. We believe it is divisive and wrong.
And then came a ludicrous attempt by the White House to persuade people that what President Trump himself had called a travel ban was in fact not a ban at all. The hapless White House spokesman at the time, Sean Spicer.
It can't be a ban if you're letting a million people in. If 325,000 people from another country can't come in, that is by nature not a ban.
The courts didn't buy it and stopped it, arguing it was a ban targeting people specifically because of their Muslim faith and therefore illegal. On Twitter, the president slammed what he called so-called judges, and in person he went furiously after the courts.
Courts seem to be so political. A bad high school student would understand this. Anybody would understand this.
He also vented his fury towards the media, whose coverage of the travel ban stuck in his craw.
I listened to a bunch of stuff last night on television that was disgraceful. It was disgraceful.
And that set the tone for the opening weeks of the Trump presidency. He signed executive order after executive order, giving the impression that he thought the presidency was all about governing by decree, not working within America's constitutional system. It divides power between the presidency, the Congress, and the courts. And the president chipped away at public confidence in the fourth estate, the press, at one point saying this.
It's frankly disgusting the way the press is able to write whatever they want to write, and people should look into it.
And then taking his battle against fake news to an utterly dyspeptic press conference, and this memorable exchange with CNN's Jim Acosta.
Since you are attacking our news organization, can you give us a chance?
Your organization.
You are attacking our news organization. Can you give us a chance to ask a question, sir?
Go ahead.
Sir, can you give us a question?
Don't be
rude. You're attacking us. Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
Can you give us a question?
I'm not going to give you a question.
You
are fake news.
We've never seen anything like that before in Washington, nor this. An assertion by the president's advisor, Kellyanne Conway, in an interview with NBC, that there are two kinds of facts.
You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts? Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
Sean Spicer, of course, was destined to resign his post as White House press secretary. He told lie after lie from behind the White House podium, and that is a fact. But someone else who also lied was also making headlines less than a month into the presidency. None other than National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who was fired by President Trump on Valentine's Day, right in the middle of Clive Ball's program.
What's been going on, Simon?
The questions that are being asked here now are not why he's resigned so quickly after moving into the National Security Council, but why it's taken 3.5 weeks for Donald Trump to get rid of him. Because it was apparent a month ago that Michael Flynn had not been truthful about the conversations that he had had with the Russian ambassador to the United States.
And indeed, Michael Flynn has now acknowledged that, entering a guilty plea to charges that he lied to the FBI. The Flynn departure was in many ways a turning point for the Trump administration. It fueled the notion that something was wrong about the Trump team's relationship with the Russians. So did another firing of the man who was investigating that relationship. News of that broke during Ian Collins' late-night programme on LBC.
Donald Trump has fired the FBI boss, James Comey, with a White House statement saying he had been terminated and removed from office.
It is not often that the director of the FBI finds himself being summarily fired by the president, especially just a matter of days after the president expressed full confidence in the director of the FBI.
The Trump team claimed Mr. Comey was gone because he mishandled an investigation into Hillary Clinton and her email, and that the president merely acted on the recommendation of top officials. White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders spun it this way for the president.
Well, I can speak to my own personal experience. I've heard from countless members of the FBI that are grateful and thankful for the president's decision.
But soon the president himself conceded that the recommendations he'd received had nothing to do with the FBI director's departure. He personally had it in for Mr. Comey.
Regardless of recommendation, I was going to fire Comey.
Why would Donald Trump take the unbelievably risky political decision to fire the very man who was investigating his campaign? James Comey himself soon provided an answer. The president, he claimed, in a one-on-one meeting, had asked him to stop investigating ties between Michael Flynn and Moscow, and Mr. Comey had refused.
He did not order you to let it go.
Again, those words are not an order.
No.
And the reason I keep saying his words is,
I took it as a direction.
Right.
I mean, this is the President of the United States with me alone saying, I hope this. I took it as this is what he wants me to do.
With talk of impeachment in the air, the next move was inevitable.
From Global's newsroom at midnight, the US Department of Justice has named a special counsel to take over the FBI inquiry into ties between President Trump's election campaign team last year and the Russians.
Enter Robert Mueller, a veteran political operator in Washington who has worked for Republican and Democratic presidents alike, and who from that moment has headed up the investigation that continues to bedevil the Trump White House. We'll talk a lot more about the Russia investigation later in the programme. And next, more of our review of Trump's first year.
Christmas on LBC. Christmas on LBC. Trump's first year with Simon Marks.
Welcome back to our review of an amazing year in Washington, and it's been a year that began with Donald Trump vowing to overturn much of Barack Obama's legacy. But in some key areas, he could not make very much progress. Even though his Republican Party controlled majorities in the House of Representatives and the Senate, he couldn't corral enough support to overturn Obamacare, a central plank of his election campaign, or secure funding to build that wall along the Mexican border. And this would prove to be a year in which US ties with Britain would be tested as never before.
The whole of the United States, as you can imagine, absolutely appalled by the scenes that everybody here is witnessing from Manchester, America.
The attack on an Ariana Grande concert at Manchester Arena brought fresh strains in the special relationship between the White House and Downing Street after US law enforcement leaked information about the investigation just hours after the attack.
We have heard, not officially from the US government, but from law enforcement sources who are briefing reporters, particularly in New York, that this was a terrorist assault using nail bombs.
So enraged were British authorities that for a while, intelligence sharing between the US and the UK ended, and the Prime Minister demanded assurances from President Trump that there would be no repetition. President Trump on the international stage spent much of the year causing a whole series of strains by implementing a foreign policy that he defines as America first.
We don't want other leaders and other countries laughing at us anymore, and they won't be.
In June, America became the first country to pull out of the Paris Climate Change Accords.
I was elected to represent the citizens of Pittsburgh. Not Paris.
The US joined only Syria and Nicaragua in not being part of that international agreement, and later in the year, the Syrians signed up for it. Towards the end of the year, another big break with the global community.
It is time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. This is nothing more or less than a recognition of reality.
He insists the move doesn't undercut efforts at establishing a two-state solution in the Middle East, but no other country followed suit, and even long-standing US allies in the region, including Saudi Arabia and Jordan, urged the president not to do it. Earlier in the year,
we had the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake that you've ever seen, and President Xi was enjoying it.
President Trump broke the news of an American missile strike on Syria to China's President Xi Jinping, with whom he was dining at his Florida golf resort.
And I said, Mr. President, let me explain something to you. This is during dessert. We've just fired 59 missiles.
But that effort did not herald any kind of ongoing military attempt to oust President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. And backed by his Russian sponsors, he's spending another new year still in power. On North Korea, though, a different approach.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
The president said the US military was locked and loaded, ready to go to war with Kim Jong-un, the North Korean strongman who received a new moniker from President Trump at the United Nations.
Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime. The United States is ready, willing and able.
U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson continued to promote the idea of dialogue with North Korea, till President Trump on Twitter said that was a waste of time. The Secretary of State, who had the rug pulled out from under him by the White House on numerous occasions throughout the year, was widely reported to have privately called President Trump a moron. He certainly didn't deny it when he went before the cameras.
This is what I don't understand about Washington. Again, you know, I'm not from this place, but the places I come from, we don't deal with that kind of petty nonsense.
And so the only denial of the moron remark came from his press secretary, Heather Nauert.
The secretary did not use that type of language to speak about the president of the United States.
But she is not widely considered the most credible person in Washington. While speculation about Rex Tillerson's survival in the president's inner circle was a popular parlor game throughout the year, there were several other players who followed him out of the White House revolving door first. That hapless press secretary, Sean Spicer.
This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period.
I always thought we'd miss him when he was gone. Gone too, an unprecedented number of other top officials. And news of their departure kept breaking for some reason during Andrew Pearce's Friday night program.
We're going back to the Washington, actually, and Simon Marks, because there's even more news. What's happened?
We have learnt, Andrew, within the last 5 minutes that there is a bloodbath underway in the West Wing of the White House.
That particular bloodbath ended the White House career of Chief of Staff Reince Priebus. He was replaced by General John Kelly, who was tasked with bringing order to an utterly chaotic West Wing. And within hours, he had claimed another scalp. Who can forget Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci?
I can't believe this, Simon.
We won't have Anthony Scaramucci to kick around anymore, Clive, to be honest. We've barely had him to kick around.
How long
to
did
begin
he last?
With. It was only 10 days ago that news was announced of his ascendance to the role of Communications Director at the White House.
But what a 10 days it was, ending with a profanity-laden exchange with a reporter in which Mr. Scaramucci described his White House colleagues as paranoid schizophrenics and said that President Trump's chief strategist Stephen Bannon was, well, let's put it this way, self-aggrandizing. Of course, Mr. Bannon didn't last either. He was gone in August as General Kelly continued cleaning house. But the general had no luck controlling Donald Trump's Twitter habit, which got the president into more trouble with the prime minister.
The fact that we work together does not mean that we're afraid to say when we think the United States have got it wrong, and to be very clear with them, and I'm very clear, that retweeting from Britain First was the wrong thing to do.
Mr. Trump would have none of it. He used Twitter to berate Theresa May by name and tell her to focus on fighting radical terrorism in Britain rather than criticising him. He had to react to two separate terror attacks on New York during his first year. In October, 8 people were killed when an Uzbek immigrant to the US slammed a rented truck into cyclists and pedestrians along a Hudson River bike path. And in December, a terrorist detonated a suicide vest in a New York bus terminal, miraculously killing no one. On both occasions, the president demanded action.
We need quick justice and we need strong justice. Much quicker and much stronger than we have right now. Because what we have right now is a joke and it's a laughingstock.
He vowed an immediate and fresh crackdown on immigration. But when it came to another violent attack in America, the president had less to say.
President Trump there acting really for the first time in his young presidency as the mourner-in-chief, the consoler-in-chief to the country after the horrific events of the last few hours. More than 50 dead, the deadliest incident of mass gun violence in modern American history.
There was no call for any kind of meaningful gun control after the Las Vegas attack in October, nor after 26 people were gunned down in a Baptist church in Texas just a few weeks later. Another event sparked a deeply controversial response from President Trump. A group of white supremacists and their supporters faced off with anti-fascist protesters in Charlottesville, Virginia. The white supremacists were there to demonstrate their support for Civil War statues and symbols that a growing number of local officials believe carry racist connotations. President Trump, reacting to the violence that left one anti-racist protester dead, ignored the advice of his aides and their prepared text, and instead said this.
I think there's blame on both sides, and I have no doubt about it, and you don't have any doubt about it either.
They showed up in Charlottesville.
Excuse me.
To protest.
Excuse me. They didn't put themselves down as you, and you had some very bad people in that group. But you also had people that were very fine people on both sides.
It took another 48 hours before, under intense public pressure, President Trump moved finally to distance himself from the racists who had descended on the Virginia University town.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence. It has no place in America.
The protests in Charlottesville were perhaps the most vivid demonstration that battle lines politically are now firmly drawn in the United States. Donald Trump remains a lightning rod. Americans either love him or loathe him. And the year ends with his approval rating having plummeted to just 32%, an unprecedentedly low number for any modern president in their first year. Democrats, picking themselves up very slowly from last year's presidential loss, are daring once again to dream after picking up a crucial U.S. Senate seat in Alabama, where the winning candidate was Doug Jones.
Alabama has been at a crossroads. We have been at crossroads in the past, and unfortunately, we have usually taken the wrong fork. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, you took the right road.
Now, I said earlier that it all began with the inauguration, but of course, in reality, it began a few weeks earlier than that, with Donald Trump's election victory. So let's briefly relive that moment of radio infamy when Ian Dale and I finally realised our predictions had been wrong. That Donald had won it.
If you're waking up to LBC's election night coverage, you're waking up to the fact that Donald Trump looks as if he's about to achieve his fantasy dream. He is within a nose hair of the White House. Simon Marks in Washington, I could never have predicted I would say those words to you.
You and me both, Ian. Absolutely stunning. A political earthquake for the ages.
And if we were gobsmacked, so was one of our guests from our studio overlooking the White House on election night, veteran Washington journalist Mike Mesetig.
Mike Mesetig, it looks like he's done it.
Indeed. This is a shock of all time. Probably, perhaps the greatest shock in the 230-year history of the American Republic. We're on a merry-go-round, and we have no idea where this is going to take us.
Well, that was then. This is now. Mike Mesetig, former foreign editor with the NewsHour on America's PBS television network, is with me in the studio. And Mike, 1 year on, how do you feel?
The merry-go-round is spinning even faster. All the authoritarian instincts that we talked about, he still demonstrates. The big question now for the United States and the rest of the world is to what extent is he going to act on them? And the decisive test is obviously in November last year. We didn't have a special prosecutor looking over his shoulder.
Mike Mesetig, the former foreign editor with the PBS NewsHour. You can follow him on Twitter at Mike Mesetig. That's one S and two T's. Coming up next, we're going to turn our attention to the Russia investigation, and we'll try to separate facts from, well, alternative facts. That's next on LBC.
This is LBC, leading Britain's conversation at Christmas. This is LBC, leading Britain's conversation, Trump's first year, with Simon Marks.
Welcome back to our two-hour special Boxing Day programme on LBC. I know some of you are sick and tired of hearing about the Russia investigation. I remember one caller a few weeks ago to Sheila Fogarty's programme, Andrew in Norwood, I think it was, who, like President Trump, argued the whole thing is fake news, a media hoax designed to discredit the president. And specifically what he suggested was that there are just no facts to back up claims of a scandal that could bring the president down. So this segment of our special programme is for all the Andrews in Norwood out there and anyone else interested in separating facts about the Russia investigation from fiction. Now let me take you back to May and to White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
When are they going to let that go? It's been going on for nearly a year. Frankly, it's kind of getting absurd. There's nothing there. We've heard that time and time again. We heard it in the testimonies earlier this week. We've heard it for the last 11 months. There is no there. It's time to move on. And it's frankly, it's time to focus on the things that the American people care about. They're not worried about this false narrative that the media continues to want to drive.
So that was May. She wanted everything wrapped up. There's nothing to see here. But now it's December, and here's what we know. Donald Trump's former campaign manager Paul Manafort and his former business associate have been charged with conspiracy and money laundering. Charges not directly connected to the election campaign, but charges that special prosecutor Robert Mueller brought as a result of his investigation into it. More seriously for the White House, former Trump foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about the timing of his communications with contacts in Russia, who said they were connected to Vladimir Putin and had dirt to dish about Hillary Clinton. And former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, once Donald Trump's right-hand man on foreign policy, has also entered a guilty plea to charges that he lied to the FBI about his conversations with the Russian ambassador to the United States. And both Mr. Papadopoulos and General Flynn are now cooperating with the Mueller inquiry. So my question for my next guest is, wasn't there really something to see there after all? Joel Pollack of Breitbart News, fiercely loyal to Donald Trump, joins me now from Los Angeles. And Joel, thanks for coming onto the program. I really appreciate it.
It's good to be with you.
Now, there was something for investigators to find out, wasn't there, even though Sarah Huckabee Sanders insisted much earlier in the year that they should stop digging and there was nothing to find. They did find stuff.
Not really. I mean, they haven't really found any evidence of collusion, and the only indictments have been either for extraneous things that predate the campaign or for lying to the FBI about matters that never reached the level of collusion. So I haven't really found anything at all, and I think they're struggling to defend the legitimacy of their investigation now. That doesn't mean they're going to stop. And with the broad sweeping powers of the special counsel, there's a lot more damage they can do. But there's nothing there, as far as we know.
But all year long, supporters of the president have said this is a shocking waste of time, it's a shocking waste of taxpayer money. And yet we've seen four people charged with alleged criminality, two of them confessing to criminality, and the investigation is by no means over yet. I mean, there is a disconnect between saying there's nothing to find there and people pleading guilty to lying to the FBI.
Well, you didn't need a special counsel to indict any of those people. So in that sense, it is a waste of time. I mean, to take Michael Flynn, for example, he has pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI, but he lied to them before the special counsel investigation. He lied to them during an FBI interview early in the year before there was a special counsel. So it's really just not clear what the special counsel is actually producing in terms of information. And the longer it goes on, the more it looks like what he's actually going to do is justify the president's claims that everything was 100% in the clear. He may even end up exonerating the president because there's just nothing there yet.
All right. So let me play you something that Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, obviously a top Trump cabinet official, said just over the last few days.
I think it should be over quickly. Since I think there's nothing there, it should be over quickly. And people want to focus on other things. We got to get past this investigation. It's a giant distraction. Nobody has said that in any way this impacted the outcome of the election.
Now, what interests me about that is that he is still characterizing this investigation as though it's all about collusion, the Russians, and the outcome of the election. But it's now about more than that, isn't it? Isn't the danger to the president that Robert Mueller is now looking at the firing of FBI Director James Comey and whether that was an attempt to obstruct justice because the president wanted the initial Russia investigation shut down?
Well, it is not possible for the president to obstruct justice if he's simply performing his constitutional duties. As James Comey himself said when he was fired, he has long believed the president has the power to fire the FBI director for any reason at all. So there's no way to charge the president with obstruction of justice in this case. It doesn't mean that theoretically a president could not be charged with obstruction if they instructed witnesses to lie and that sort of thing. But there's no evidence of any of that happening and no suspicion of it happening either. So all you have is this decision to fire Comey, which was justifiable on other grounds and which Democrats had actually been demanding for months because they were upset with the way that he handled the Hillary Clinton investigation. So there's no grounds for that either. And that doesn't mean it's going to end anytime soon. I think there are some people who would like to use the Mueller investigation to push a political agenda, to ensnare the Trump administration in investigations for months, maybe years. So I don't share the Treasury Secretary's optimism that it's going to end soon. But were it to be confined to its actual original mandate, which was investigating Russian collusion, probably would have been over already.
And let me press you on something. If there was really nothing dodgy going on, if all the communications with the Russians were perfectly normal, purer than the driven snow, why have so many people connected to President Trump at various points lied, dissembled, forgotten about them?
I don't know if they've, it's a good question in terms of the politics of it. I think that some of the explanations that we've seen for meetings haven't panned out. But again, I think that's a stretch to say that that's happened as part of a pattern. You know, there are cases where, for example, Jeff Sessions was accused of lying about his meetings with the Russian ambassador. But he didn't lie about those meetings. He wasn't required to account for those meetings, and he didn't meet them in the course of his activity with the campaign. He met them as a senator in routine meetings.
Right, so, but you've got awful lot of amnesia going on, best-case scenario and worst-case scenario, deliberately failing to tell people honestly about what was going on.
The only case I can think of where there was something that was said that turned out to be untrue was the purpose of the meeting with the Russian lawyer at Trump Tower, where there were several campaign officials at that meeting. And then, of course, it turned out not to be about Russian adoption policy, but rather to be about an effort to see what information these Russian emissaries had on Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation. Of course, that didn't pan out. There was no information, and the meeting was sort of a failure, according to accounts of what happened. But yes, the reasons that the public was given for that meeting turned out to be untrue. Whether that's a material lie or anything that rises to the level of criminality, I doubt. It certainly is a political problem, not just for Donald Trump Jr., but for the president. But I don't think there's any kind of widespread pattern of that kind of dissembling. And I think Democrats have hyped some of the things people have said about meetings as if they were lies. But again, I think, you know, Jeff Sessions, I mean, earlier in the year, for just another example, we were told that he didn't disclose meetings with Russians to the FBI when he was applying to be the attorney general. And now we learn the FBI didn't require him to disclose them. So he didn't lie at all. It just simply wasn't important to the procedure. And anyway, I think that it's all a bit of a stretch. There are some things that have happened that have been politically damaging to the president and have turned out to be not as people were originally thought they were. But again, it's a very complicated campaign. There are a lot of meetings that happen, and I think some people genuinely do forget things. I mean, I think it's normal. I meet with a lot of people. I can't remember who I've met. I can't even remember names sometimes, you know, with faces. I mean, it's embarrassing at social functions, but I mean, it's normal. We don't remember meetings that are not consequential. And since that Russian meeting was basically a failure, it wouldn't be a surprise that they had forgotten what it was originally about.
All right. Joel Pollack of Breitbart News, as I said, fiercely loyal to President Trump. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you.
Next, President Trump's destiny will not be decided by the people who didn't vote for him in the 2016 election. 2017 has made it clear that his future will hinge on those people who did back him. We'll explore the Republican opposition to the Trump presidency when our special program continues here on LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation at Christmas, LBC. Christmas on LBC, Trump's first year with Simon Marks.
Welcome back to our special programme from Washington. And in this part of the programme, we're going to examine the opposition to President Trump. No, not the Democrats, not the progressives, not the liberal media, not the people who take to the streets to demonstrate against him, most of whom never voted for him in the first place. Instead, we're going to talk about these people.
You know, resentment is not a governing philosophy. At some point, we've got to actually have policies that work, not just rile up the base. And so, yeah, I do think the party will come back around. Otherwise, we'll be a minority party for a long time.
I don't know why he lowers himself to such a low, low standard and debases our country in the way that he does, but he does. He's obviously not going to rise to the occasion as president.
Half-baked, spurious nationalism cooked up by people who would rather find scapegoats than solve problems.
Senators Jeff Flake, Bob Corker and John McCain, all senior Republicans up on Capitol Hill, and each of them appalled by the president and what he stands for. Two people with very different vantage points. John Gizzi is the White House correspondent for the conservative-leaning news organization Newsmax. His boss, Chris Ruddy, is a close friend of Donald Trump. And on the line from San Antonio in Texas is an old friend of mine, Trey Ware, who I can best describe as the Nick Ferrari of South Texas. He's the morning show host on legendary radio station KTSA. And Trey, let me start with you down in San Antonio. We are seeing Donald Trump end the year with just awful approval ratings, hovering in the low 30s. You live in a part of the country where he's got lots of supporters. Are they sticking with him?
Oh, absolutely, Simon. They definitely are. They believe here because the proof is in the pudding. All those guys that you just played, whether it's Flake or McCain or Corker or any of them who originally, if you remember, Mitt Romney gave that very long speech about Donald Trump prior to the election as well. And everybody here is realizing now the proof is in the pudding. When we see what's happening with the stock market, when we see what's happening with the tax plan that has passed, when we see what's happening with record low unemployment, particularly in the Latino community here, and the black community has an unemployment rate at a 17-year low, a lot of people are putting their faith and trust. They may have been skeptical a little bit at first, at the beginning of the Trump administration, but now they're looking and saying, hey, this is actually working out. The proof is in the pudding, as we say.
Yeah, but hang on a second, Trey. He hasn't drained the swamp, as he put it, here in Washington.
No,
he hasn't
not yet.
Built the wall along the Mexico border. That's a big issue in your part of the world. He
not
hasn't
yet.
Repealed and reformed Obamacare, which he said he would do. He hasn't closed America's borders to Muslims, just to some of them. Again, another promise broken. And legislatively, sure, he's got the tax cut passed, but it's not clear that many of his voters will see immediate benefits from that. So why the loyalty to him?
Well, we can take each of those issues, but it would take too long to go through all of those. I can tell you this, though, when you talk about draining the swamp, the three that we played at the top of the program here, you played at the top of the program, they are going to be leaving their Senate seats very soon. And there are those others. We've had a record number, I believe, this year of those in Congress saying, I'm not coming back. I am choosing to step out of this and do something else with my life. Some of them are Republicans who have been the traditional, if you will, establishment Republicans for quite some time. Rome wasn't built in a night and or in a day, as they say, and some of these things are going to take a very long time. He has had a solid year of media in the states that has been opposed to him. You've had a solid year of the permanent state in Washington that's been opposed to him, blocking him at every turn, but that is slowly changing, Simon. I think that people who are at least plugged into this kind of thing realize that change is actually happening.
So, John Gizzi, let's get to this issue of the opposition within. Trey was sort of intimating there that men like Jeff Flake, the senator from Arizona, are basically part of the problem. They're part of the swamp. Let's just take a listen to what Senator Flake said on the floor of the Senate earlier this year, announcing that as far as his relationship with Donald Trump was concerned, he'd reached the end of the road.
The notion that one should stay silent and as the norms and values that keep America strong are undermined, and as the alliances and agreements that ensure the stability of the entire world are routinely threatened by the level of thought that goes into 140 characters. The notion that we should say or do nothing in the face of such mercurial behavior is ahistoric, and I believe profoundly misguided.
And John Gizzi, he's not the only one. Bob Corker famously on Twitter called the White House an adult daycare center. This is a pretty astonishing moment for a party that controls the White House and majorities in both houses of Congress, isn't it?
Yes, but you know, Simon, if you've been around long enough reporting, you always see analogies. Mark Twain once said, "History doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it rhymes." I'm old enough to remember when Ted Heath and Reggie Maudling and other figures from the past of the Tory party railed against the imperious and boorish Margaret Thatcher. And I would characterize them as figures from the past. So it is. You've quoted to me two senators who are retiring this year and making obscene gestures on the way out the door.
Well, let me play you a quote from someone that you may consider a figure of the future. We'll find out. The president's ousted grey cardinal, his kind of ideological Svengali, Stephen Bannon, hitting out at those Republicans who criticize the president.
They have to understand, there's a basic agenda that President Trump ran on and won. He carried states the Republicans haven't carried in living memory. Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. This agenda works. The American people voted for it. It is incumbent upon them to back President Trump's plan, but you don't see it. And we're going to go after him. There's a coalition coming together that's going to challenge every Republican incumbent except for Ted Cruz.
John Gizzi, he's talking about civil war within the party.
He is, and I would just say with respect to Steve Bannon, someone who served his country in uniform and had a lightning career in the private sector, cool it a bit. Roger Wicker, senator from Mississippi, has a 90% rating with the American Conservative Union, backs the president over 91% of the time. I would say, again, with respect, that he might clarify his remarks a little bit. There are 10 Republican senators up, including Ted Cruz, including Roger Wicker of Mississippi, and others. 25 Democratic senators. Maybe he has a little bit more vulnerable targets going after those Democrats than hunting in it within his own reserve.
Steve Bannon is a very different type of Republican than the Republicans that have traditionally come to Washington and on occasion governed in Washington. And I wonder at the end of the day, is Donald Trump really a Republican?
Donald Trump is a populist Republican. In many ways, he's like the former presidential candidate and high priest of punditry, Pat Buchanan. He belongs to the Republican Party, but he will offer views from trade to foreign policy that differ with many who hold office within the party, but which has a following among the proverbial grassroots of the party.
And if I can insert myself in here, too, gentlemen, I would also say that he is very well, or could very well be, and the jury is still out, the future of politics in America. I know younger generations, the millennials and what have you, are not so concerned about the letter that you have behind your name. They don't care so much whether or not you're a Republican or a Democrat. What they care about is what are you doing and how are you getting it done. That's their focus. And so you're going to see, I believe, the traditional lines that are from John's time and my time and your time, Simon, a lot of that's going to change. A lot of that's going to be blurred because there won't be so much this adherence and this loyalty to I have to toe this line because I'm a Democrat, or I have to toe this line because it's a Republican line or whatever. And Donald Trump, I think, is probably somebody who represents that to a lot of people. I think that, you know, when he certainly was not a Republican early on in his life and also leading up to most recent memory, but he's certainly implementing a lot of programs and a lot of plans that Republicans would favor deeply.
So let me ask you both, as we head into midterm election year, Trey Ware down in Texas, candidates for the House down there, will they want Donald Trump to come and campaign with them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think the Republican candidates down here definitely would like to have him here, particularly if we see in February and throughout the springtime the reaction that we anticipate out of the tax plan, they'll really want him here.
And John?
Yes, particularly in Trey's home state of Texas, throughout the South and the West. It'll be welcome, Donald, welcome.
I want to ask you both a final question. John, first to you. I mean, both of you, of course, know that there is no official leader of the opposition in America like we have in the UK. And I wonder if you think that's a problem for President Trump. I mean, surely, as we head into 2018, he can't keep going after Hillary Clinton, and it'll be months before we have any idea who's going to lead the Democrats into 2020's election.
He needs Jeremy Corbyn.
I think Jeremy Corbyn might be otherwise occupied.
Yes.
I mean, but does he need a target? Does he need someone?
I think he needs the controlled chaos that is the current Democratic Party more than he needs a leader of the loyal opposition, as you put it. The fact is that Democrats are so divided, their family is so dysfunctional, and they have no leadership come up. It's very much like the Tory party in Britain after Margaret Thatcher stepped down and Major lost. It's like the Labour Party until Corbyn came up. There is no one to lead them and be a target, and I think he rather prefers this disunity right now.
You agree with that, Trey, or do you think he does better when he's got a clear, identifiable enemy to go after?
No, I agree with John 110%, because when you think about it, the Democrats don't have a vision, and much less anybody who can express that vision right now. And Donald Trump does like that chaos over there. He plays off of it very well. And if you look at his Twitter account, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing that he is on Twitter, if you look at his Twitter account, there's no shortage of people for him to go after.
And there will be no shortage, doubtless, of presidential tweets in 2018.
No
Trey
doubt.
Ware of KTSA Radio, it is great to talk to you. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you, Simon, and thank you, John. It's been a real pleasure.
And
always
John Gizzi,
a pleasure.
And John Gizzi of Newsmax, thanks to both of you. And a reminder that whatever happens in America's midterm elections next November, you will, of course, find unparalleled coverage of the campaigning, the voting, and the results right here on LBC.
Coming up on LBC, Trump's first year with Simon Marks.
Up next, why do Trump's generals work for him? The Brits in Washington, past and present, and Nigel Farage too, after the news.
Trump's first year with Simon Marks on LBC. This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation. Trump's first year with Simon Marks.
Welcome to the second hour of our special programme from Washington. I'm Simon Marks, LBC's US correspondent, looking back at a roller coaster year here in the US Capitol. And if it was tough for all of us to keep up with the hurricane of activity at the White House, imagine what it was like for the three men who now find themselves very much at the centre of President Trump's orbit, or perhaps in the eye of President Trump's storm. It is apparent that Donald Trump likes military generals, so much so that three of them now occupy absolutely pivotal positions within his White House. In July, General John Kelly was brought in as President Trump's new chief of staff, tasked with bringing order and discipline to a White House that up until then had exhibited neither. Also serving the president, General H.R. McMaster, who became his national security advisor after the firing of the Russia-tarnished and disgraced General Michael Flynn. And making up the troika, the mad dog, General James Mattis, who, as the president's defense secretary, has turned out not to be that much of a mad dog after all. So why are these three men each agreeing to serve Donald Trump in the White House? With me now to explore that, one of Washington's preeminent observers, Susan Glasser, the chief international affairs columnist with Politico. And Susan, thanks very much indeed for joining us on the program. What's up here? I understand why the president wanted the generals, but why did the generals want the president?
Well, look, it's a good question, and it's one that is really an endless subject of Washington parlor game guessing, really, over the course of last year. But there is a difference between not all generals are created equal at this point in time. Remember that H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, is a three-star general, but he's a current general. That means he received an order, in effect, from his commander-in-chief. So he would have had a much harder time, really, demurring, even if he didn't really want to serve as National Security Advisor, and no one thinks this was a job that he was sitting around bucking for, but he remains a sitting general while also serving in that post, whereas Generals Mattis and Kelly, the White House Chief of Staff, General Kelly, and the Defense Secretary are both retired generals, they're former generals, and so they certainly had more leeway to choose. But again, I don't think anyone thinks that either of them was desperate to serve Donald Trump either.
So let's break it down, because you're absolutely right. They're not monolithic. And let's take a look at these men individually, starting out with General Kelly. He was brought in as the new White House Chief of Staff to clean the place up, bring order to chaos. At the end of the year, how do you think he's doing?
Well, look, it's a good reminder that effective staff work is only as effective on some level as the boss. And Donald Trump is ending his first year in office as the most unpopular first year president that we've had in modern times in the United States. On the one hand, on the other hand, by all accounts, the processes in the West Wing, the actual functions of staffing the White House have clearly improved, settled into something that is much more recognizably the American White House than it was in the chaotic early days surrounding Trump's presidency. And I think we've learned a lot about General Kelly as well in the course of the last 6 months. One of the things that I increasingly hear from people here in Washington is them making a distinction between General Kelly and Madison McMaster, and viewing Kelly as more of someone who seems to share some of Donald Trump's political beliefs.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I was going to take us back in time a little bit to one of General Kelly's briefings for reporters, because for a long while, it seemed that no one in Washington really had an appreciation or an understanding of General Kelly's own politics. But then he spoke to reporters in the aftermath of claims by the widow of a slain soldier that Donald Trump, in a presidential phone call of condolence, had told her that her husband knew what he was signing up for. The conversation was reported by a congresswoman who was listening to the call, and it elicited this response from General Kelly.
It stuns me that a member of Congress would have listened in on that conversation. Absolutely stuns me. And I thought, at least that was sacred. You know, when I was a kid growing up, a lot of things were sacred in our country. Women were sacred and looked upon with great honor. That's obviously not the case anymore, as we see from recent cases. Life, the dignity of life, was sacred. That's gone. Religion, that seems to be gone as well. Gold Star families, I think that left in the convention over the summer. But I just thought the selfless devotion that brings a man or woman to die on the battlefield, I just thought that that might be sacred.
Susan Glass, a real fury there on the part of General Kelly, who, of course, himself lost a son on the battlefield. But it's also pretty revealing of his own political outlook, isn't it?
Well, that's right. Look, I'm glad it's powerful to hear the whole thing again in full. I think it is arguably sort of the moment when John Kelly became political and stepped out in front of a broad national audience and made it clear in some way that we had not fully understood until then how on board he is with the Trump presidency. And, you know, look, I got to say, right, it's pretty rich to hear General Kelly lecturing Americans about the lack of sacredness while serving a president who's brought, you know, the most crude standards, unimaginably crude standards, to the White House and, you know, attacking those same Gold Star families that General Kelly claims to venerate. So it's shocking all around. Many people were surprised that he didn't apologize after this to the family, especially in light of what we now know about the horrific way in which that young man apparently died in the attack. And so it's a sad episode all around, but I think you're right to point out that it was a revealing one.
And also General Kelly, who many people thought might finally come to grips with Donald Trump's Twitter habit, has recently said of the president's tweets, they are what they are. Does that mean he's given up?
Well, again, I'm glad you spotlighted this. This is something we hear from General Kelly and increasingly from others who serve the president, including those on his national security team. I find this to be one of the most jarring aspects of the Trump presidency at the end of 1 year, this notion that somehow everything is just fine. We have a great national security, for example, strategy. If only we just ignore the president and whether he himself actually agrees to it. And, you know, initially, right, they said ignore the Twitter stream. Now, of course, they realize Trump has actually affected real-world events with it, foreign governments, everybody's wise to the fact that this actually represents the undiluted thought stream, the id, if you will, of the President of the United States, so we're not going to ignore it. So now they don't say ignore it, but effectively they say don't elevate its importance, look at what we do, not what he says. And I find that to be the emerging kind of head snapping. It's kind of like the cognitive dissonance of the Trump presidency.
So let's turn to General H.R. McMaster. You mentioned him before, the National Security Advisor. He is a serving member of the military. And when Donald Trump asked him to head the National Security Council, as you pointed out, he snapped to attention and said yes. He came in highly respected. He literally wrote the book on when the military has to tell uncomfortable truths to politicians in power. And yet here was General McMaster carrying President Trump's water and accusing the Washington Post of fake news when it revealed earlier this year that the president had disclosed classified intelligence to the Russians during an Oval Office meeting.
There's nothing that the president takes more seriously than the security of the American people. The story that came out tonight, as reported, is false. At no time, were intelligence sources or methods discussed. And the president did not disclose any military operations that were not already publicly known. And I was in the room. It didn't happen.
Susan Glasser, he was in the room, says it didn't happen, except with the benefit of hindsight, we all now know that it did.
Well, that's right. It seemed like, at a minimum, a lot of angels dancing on the head of a pin and hair splitting of a legalistic sort going into that answer. And disingenuous is the very best case interpretation of that comment you just played from General McMaster. You know, no one really knows, obviously, what's inside the heads of these folks at this point in time. I have a friend here in Washington, Tom Wright. He's from the Brookings Institution. He's emerged as sort of an astute Trump whisperer, if you will, on foreign policy. He and I were talking about this very dilemma the other day. How do we understand what's going on with General McMaster, highly respected, as you pointed out, in all these circles? He said it reminds him of the movie Donnie Brasco. I don't know if you remember that, but it's basically a film involving an FBI effort to place an informant deeply undercover inside the mafia. And, of course, to really gain credibility in the mafia, Donnie Brasco is required to do all sorts of very heinous things. And, you know, his old colleagues are left wondering. He seems to be such a good mafioso. In fact, they're left wondering whether he's really still on the good guys' team. And that kind of sums up a lot of the speculating about General McMaster now.
And what's your thought? How badly tarnished is someone like H.R. McMaster? Because it's not normal or usual for military figures to be dragged into political battles, and they don't normally like it.
Look, I think that it's impossible to answer that question yet because we don't know how the story ends. And, of course, we don't know what General McMaster will ultimately end up doing. And, you know, the scenario where he, you know, quits in a blaze of outrage is a very different scenario than the one where he goes down with the ship and is revealed to be, you know, a true America First believer. You know, we don't know. We just don't know the ending of the story yet. I think most people believe that McMaster is a genuinely principled person and who has committed his life to serve his country. And so let's go with that.
All right. Well, the final chapter of his story is yet to be written. So too the final chapter of the story of James Mattis, the defense secretary. Here's something that he said earlier this year to a group of troops when he was visiting the Middle East.
He says, hold the line until our country gets back to understanding and respecting each other and showing it, being friendly to one another. You know, that Americans owe to one another. We're so doggone lucky to be Americans.
Hold the line until our country gets back to normal was essentially General Mattis's message there. Susan Glasser, he was hardly blowing the bugle for President Trump there.
No, look, I mean, by all accounts, there's certainly a sense among what I would call the Washington establishment, for lack of a better phrase, in both parties, that sees General Mattis as really the sort of cornerstone at this point, the bedrock of American and therefore global national security. He's emerged with the fewest Trumpian scars after 1 year. Trump still appears to respect him and to be perhaps even a bit intimidated by him. And, he has not done some of the over-the-top acts of sycophantism that you've seen from some of the others.
I was told by one visiting defense minister here this year that General Mattis walked into the room and introduced himself as the Secretary for Reassurance. what is the thinking in Washington about these guys as the year ends? Are they, as many people I think initially hoped and argued, are they going to be the men who throw themselves, if necessary, between President Donald Trump and the nuclear button? Or might they, under certain circumstances, guide him towards it and actually help him use it?
You know, again, this is the subject of so much debate and discussion here in Washington this year. By the way, that in and of itself, of course, is completely unprecedented and a sign of this extraordinary time that we're living in. There was this sort of adults in the room theory of the case, right? That's tempered after a year. It's been clear that Donald Trump, especially when domestic politics or his campaign season promises get in the way, is willing and, in fact, has on multiple occasions overruled General Mattis as well as General McMaster and, of course, his beleaguered Secretary of State Rex Tillerson on various important foreign policy issues, including, I'm told most recently, just the decision on recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Both Mattis and Tillerson, I was told, begged. That was the word, begged the president not to do it. He did it anyways. So Mattis is not an absolute fail-safe bulwark against presidential decision-making in a system which endows the president himself with these powers and not his advisors, you know? And we've learned that. Donald Trump doesn't want to be anybody's puppet, and in fact, I'm sure nothing outrages him more than the idea that we all think that these people are puppeting him around like a marionette.
Absolutely. Susan Glasser, she's the chief international columnist with Politico. You can read her terrific writings at politico.com and listen to her podcast, The Global Politico, every week. It offers tremendous insights into what's going on here. Susan Glasser, thanks very much indeed for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Next, we're going back in time.
George Bush began his victory speech the way such speeches always begin.
I've just received a telephone call from Governor Dukakis.
Voices who covered Washington in the past on LBC with their views of what's going on here today. Plus, Nigel Farage. Did he ever mention that he knows Donald Trump? And our special roundtable with the Brits. That's all ahead on LBC.
Christmas on LBC. This is LBC, leading Britain's conversation. Trump's first year with Simon Marks.
Hello again from Washington. I'm Simon Marks, and this segment of the program is in some ways for veteran listeners of LBC, although you don't have to be one to enjoy it. Because before I trod the streets of Washington for this great radio station, there were others who went before me.
George Bush began his victory speech the way such speeches always begin.
I've just received a telephone call from Governor Dukakis.
The character of the next phase of battle will be determined by the results of detailed analysis of the destruction already wrought and by whatever moves Saddam Hussein might still make. This is Nick Peters in Washington for LBC News Talk 97.3.
If you are a listener of a certain age, that voice will bring back memories. Nick Peters was LBC's Washington correspondent from 1988 until 1991. He lived here in Washington until 2002, for a good chunk of that time, covered events for LBC and Independent Radio News. And I'm very happy to say that he's joining me now from London, and also joining me from London, an old friend of mine, James Mates from ITV News, who trod the sidewalks here for News at 10 from 1997 until 2003. He is now ITV News Europe editor. When he was here in Washington, he also appeared from time to time on LBC. Nick and James, thanks so much to both of you for coming in. I wanted to ask you both, we are at the end of a truly bruising year in terms of the relationship between the White House and the reporters who cover it. And I wonder, Nick Peters first, because you were here first. When you were here, what was that relationship like?
It was always distant in the sense that the presidency itself was always kept at arm's length. We were treated, I would have to say, the old press room in the White House was an absolute hovel, and the journalists were treated with enormous contempt just by the fact that the network news anchors and so on all had to operate in tiny cubby holes. There was only one miserable little microwave, and it was hell on earth if you were on a long stakeout. But even so, there was at a certain level a degree of trust, and a degree that, you know, at the end of the day, that there was a certain understanding that things would be at least dealt with fairly, and reporters were dealt with fairly. What I've witnessed in the last year here in London, looking over at the States and seeing the outright contempt with which media have been treated, is truly astonishing.
I think you ought to come back, because they've got quite a nice espresso maker there now. But James, you watch all of this, as I said, from your vantage point as Europe correspondent for ITV News. But you were here during the George W. Bush era. He never really cared that much for the press, but there was a fundamental respect there for the institution of the Fourth Estate and the free media, wasn't there?
Without question, with all the presidents. I was there with Clinton as well. It was a respect for the truth as much as anything else, a respect for the fact that the media were there with a job to do. And even if they didn't like us very much, there were sort of rights and privileges of things that, you know, you had a right to expect, which was a certain degree of access, much more if you were from a US network than if you were from No Votes TV, as we were known in the foreign press. But nonetheless, there was a certain degree of access and a certain right to expect that what you were being told was at least close to the truth, even if Bill Clinton famously made declarations about the Lewinsky scandal that didn't necessarily live up to the badge of honest and open. But nonetheless, there was a certain respect for the truth, and there was consequences for not telling the truth. And that's what seems so different now.
And Nick, I mean, I think that gets to the heart of it, doesn't it? A president who, you know, constantly, day after day, hour after hour, dismisses the free press as the fake news media, whose senior counselor, we heard her earlier on the program, talks about a White House that disseminates alternative facts. And White House press secretaries, Sean Spicer and now Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who, unlike any of their predecessors, Republican or Democrat alike, are willing on a regular basis to tell falsehoods on behalf of the man that they represent. I mean, that's a stunning change.
It is indeed. And I have to say that it's of a piece with the entire Trump presidency. It's like he's opened a Pandora's box. The fact that he can get away with this and that his core electorate, although his ratings are way down in the low 30s, as I understand it, but his core electorate just believe that it's time the liberal media got their comeuppance. And he can play that game in the same way as I call it a Pandora's box. It's like he's allowed all these furies to come out. It's an absolute mystery to me how anybody's going to be able to put them back in the box. I think we've entered a whole new uncharted territory. And I do believe that this level of mendacity that goes on at the moment, how anybody is going to sweep that Augean stable clean, I just cannot fathom.
James, can we talk inevitably about the president's use of Twitter? I have been here long enough, and you were here at a time when presidential statements had real weight to them. Now, presidential statements, we are told by the White House, are basically whatever Donald Trump wants to tap out on his phone in his pyjamas. And I wonder if European leaders, including the Prime Minister, are getting used in any way to the presidential use of Twitter and the risks that it poses?
Well, I've seen very little in the way of European leaders emulating him in terms of the slightly inchoate sort of, get up in the morning, fire off the first thought that comes into your head or response to something you've just seen on telly, style of Twitter use. Although clearly harnessing social media is something that leaders are all over the continent are having to get to grips with, not least because their oppositions, people who would replace them in power are beginning to use it very, very effectively indeed. So you are seeing a lot more of that. But I don't think I have seen any example so far of a serious mainstream European leader coming anywhere close. Emmanuel Macron uses it very, very effectively, but in a pretty staid way.
And Nick, as you look back on your time in Washington, I mean, there was, until Trump, a pretty cozy relationship that existed between the media and the White House. You know, the dinners, the White House Correspondents Association event once a year, the congressional dinner where the president would always come along and yuck it up with members of the press. I have to say, I've always found those events somewhat uncomfortable. It's not all that bad that he's pierced that, is it?
Well, no, I must say, and it may be because, like James, I was very much in no votes media when I was in Washington, that you couldn't help but feel that there was a rather too cozy relationship between the White House and certain elements, senior elements of the American media. And I don't know whether that was just us feeling sort of noses pressed up against the window, looking in from the cold outside. But I do feel that it never hurts for media to be kept on their toes. Our job is to keep politicians on theirs. And I think that any time it gets a little bit too cozy, it just becomes difficult because the people who desperately need to understand the truth are the readers, the listeners, the viewers. And if they're somehow getting the message through something that's intermediated without total clarity, then I think that is not necessarily right. But that is nothing compared with what is going on now. I was horrified to see that after the train crash in Washington State, that the first thing Trump did was to tweet about his infrastructure policy, grandstanding, self-aggrandizing, and then 10 minutes later said, my thoughts are with anybody who was hurt or killed. I mean, just absolute. This man is almost inhuman in his crassness. And what the damage he's doing to the presidency, let alone to the media, is incalculable.
If I might say Simon, I do slightly disagree with Nick on that. And I think that one doesn't want to confuse the message of Trump, which has its own qualities, if I can put it that way, and the processes of how the US media and the White House interact. I mean, in many ways, I think it's much less cozy and incestuous than the lobby system in the UK, in that There, the daily briefings are open and televised. Most U.S. media will not use unattributable comments most of the time, if they can possibly help it. Certainly not to the extent that that we do. Whereas in the UK, virtually everything is unattributable. No one will speak on the record. A lot of it is done by nods and winks and briefings without being told that this is a nod and a wink and a briefing. We see this all the time. You know, something emerging from number 10, and you simply don't know where it's come from, or whether it's an ally or some sort of intrigue that is behind it all. So in many ways, I think I found the U.S. system much more open, albeit we were kept at arm's length. Now, I don't know, because I'm not dealing with it, how that process has changed. Though clearly, the message and the reliability of your interactions with the U.S. media are very, very different now.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and thank you, James, for picking me up on that. Yes, indeed, that sort of day-to-day relationship is much more open. I think what I was referring to was a much more cozy behind-the-scenes sort of the dinner party circuit in the US, and it's no different in the UK, I suppose, as well. I just haven't really observed it. But it is a kind of coziness where we don't know what those relationships were quite like, what was said at those meetings. But yes, on a daily basis, it is much clearer in the United States than it is in the UK, although I have to say was. I suspect now that relationship has been blown to pieces.
Well, I think we can say without fear of contradiction that this is a story that will run and run in 2018 and will doubtless continue to be a page-turner. James Mates of ITV News, Nick Peters, now editorial director of The Manufacturer magazine, but an LBC veteran. You can follow them on Twitter at JamesMatesITV and at Nick Peters Media. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much indeed, Simon.
Thank you, Simon.
Next, he's a relatively new voice on LBC, but already very much part of the furniture. I'll talk to Nigel Farage after the break.
This is LBC, leading Britain's conversation at Christmas. Christmas on LBC, Trump's first year with Simon Marks.
And we're back from Washington as we look back on an astonishing year in the USA. A few months ago, a listener to Ian Dale at Drive texted the programme while I was on it and challenged me to say something nice about President Trump. Well, it's taken a few months, but I can finally answer the question. If it hadn't been for Donald Trump, I might never have met my next guest on the programme, Nigel Farage, host of The Nigel Farage Show on LBC. He is with me now. And I suppose we should tell listeners that when Nigel travels, and he travels all the time, your programme comes to LBC from our studios here in Washington and sometimes in other places. And it has genuinely been great fun getting to know Nigel. And now I get to turn the tables and ask him the question. So I want to probe here. I know you are an admirer of Donald Trump. You campaigned for him, much to Hillary Clinton's irritation. You were the first foreign political leader to walk through the doors of Trump Tower in the immediate aftermath of his election victory. But I want to find out just how far down the Trump train tracks you chug before you slip off into a siding. So why don't you start just by telling us, what is it that you admire about him?
Instinct. You know, he's not an Ivy League man. He's not an intellectual. He doesn't come from any of the conventional backgrounds these days that you would expect from a global leader. But he's kind of made his own way in life. He's the self-made real estate man from New York. He's the guy that took reality TV to astonishing heights in terms of people watching it and advertising revenues and all of that stuff. And I, do you know something? I'm absolutely, after nearly 20 years in this game, I am sick to death of the college kids. Straight out of Oxford, straight into Parliament. They're the kind of people that have been running the West for the last couple of decades, doing it, in my view, pretty badly. And I see a guy here who actually gets it. He sees there is a major change in Western politics that is taking place. And I admire him because I trust his instincts. I admire him for his guts. And my goodness me, he's strong as an ox given the kind of opposition that he faces. So I think Trump's got it right. I think Trump sees the big change that's happening in global politics. And I think right now, and yeah, of course, he's a disruptor. I get that. You know, I guess in some ways, I've been a bit of a disruptor. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, when you want to change things, you know, you can't make an omelette without breaking eggs.
Well, he's certainly broken eggs. How worried are you for him, given that he's ending the year with historically low approval ratings? I mean, seriously historically low. And he's not been able to get that much done up on Capitol Hill, at least, despite enjoying majorities in both houses of Congress.
Yeah, it's been very difficult. I mean, look, let's face it. You know, just as Parliament and the establishment don't want Brexit to happen, there is still, here in Washington, most people, even in the Republican Party, have not reconciled themselves to Donald Trump being the 45th president of the USA. He has faced obstructionism from the judges. He now has this Mueller investigation, this special investigation into any supposed Russian links in the election. And it's there. It's drip, drip, drip. Negativity every single day coming out from mainstream media, and he's found it very difficult to pass much in the House. Against that, I would say, just have a think about his achievements this year. A massive reduction in illegal immigration into the USA. Hundreds of thousands of jobs back in manufacturing. And whatever his personal approval ratings are, and this is interesting, the optimism that he's created around the US economy. And you've seen those numbers too. They are growing by the day. You know, sometimes you don't have to like somebody to think they're good for your country. And I would look at the economic optimism figures more than his popularity ratings.
All right, lightning round, because I still want to find out where you part company with him.
Yeah.
The firing of James Comey, the FBI director.
Biggest mistake.
Dumb.
The biggest single mistake that has happened within this time. But yeah, look, Comey was behaving very badly. Comey was leaking stuff to the press. He wasn't behaving well. But it's that classic one, isn't it? Do you want somebody inside the tent or somebody outside the tent? And it was. And I think they should have lived with Comey. The president took the wrong advice. There were clearly two wings, two competing arguments within the West Wing, and I think he made a big mistake.
Are you not discomforted when you hear the president characterising some of those white supremacist marchers in Virginia earlier this year as very fine people?
I'm very discomforted that the American media has reached the point where a right-wing protest, within which there were some really very extreme and really horrendous people, but most of them weren't neo-Nazis. Most of them were concerned people. What really worries me...
Well, hang on a second.
What really worries me... But this is the point, isn't it? You guys obsess about right-wing extremists. What about left-wing extremists? What about these Antifa people who are very happy to be violent pretty much at any protest they go to? So what Trump said after Charlottesville is there was fault on both sides, and that is true.
But very fine people.
Look, please, you know, I personally wouldn't want anything to do with the Richard Spencer sort of neo-Nazi white supremacist types that do exist here in the USA. They've always existed here, actually, in the USA. But to characterise absolutely everybody that objected to the removal of a Civil War statue as all being extremists would be wrong too.
I want to talk about his situation with regard to America's role in the world. The State Department, many foreign policy observers in Washington believe, is a shell of its former self. Democracy promotion, open society reform, war crimes, monitoring.
War. All America. No. I'm sorry. This agenda that has been pushed, not just by the neocons in the Republican Party, actually, but Democrats completely bought into this too. The Clintons and Blair, of course, in the United Kingdom. Democracy promotion is the name used for an endless series of foreign wars that have achieved, frankly, nothing. It's cost America $5.5 trillion since Afghanistan and going through Iraq and everything else. And I think it is very refreshing to now have a leader who is much more in touch with public opinion across the West. You know, going to war should be the last resort of a government, not the first.
But what happened to Ronald Reagan's shining city on the hill, the example for the rest of the world to follow? this is not an example for the rest of the world to follow, because he's largely, in many ways, disengaged from the rest of the world.
I just don't buy that at all. I really think if you look at the speech he gave in Riyadh, which was his first foreign visit, there he was talking to some of the biggest Muslim leaders in the world, saying, I'm not against you guys, I want to work with you guys, but you must drive out of your places of worship those who wish us harm. I thought that was actually giving global leadership. I watched him in Warsaw. I watched him in Paris on Bastille Day. And, of course, the visit to China, where he conducted himself in a way that I don't think anybody here in this city could believe. He has conducted himself on the world stage very well indeed. And the message is, yeah, it's America first, but not to the exclusion of wanting to do the right thing globally. And I think America's standing in the world at the end of this year is much higher than it was at the start.
But how can you justify that position? I mean, America has traditionally, under Republican and Democratic presidents past, consistently sort of pushed a message of, we're going to judge countries partly by their human rights positions. This is a president who seems to hew naturally towards leaders like Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines, President Erdogan in Turkey, Xi Jinping in China, Vladimir Putin in Russia. None of them paragons of human rights virtue.
No, well, in the name of human rights, we've gone to war all over the world. We've killed a couple of million people. And we've spent trillions of dollars. I would suggest to you that those like the Obamas and the Clintons and the Bushes, who gave us this lovely soft message of peace and democracy, actually achieved the opposite. And I think you have a president here who does not want to get involved in a whole series of foreign wars. The one thing he has done, is he's woken the world up to the threat that North Korea poses. And I think we should all be very grateful, actually.
All right, well, we'll see where that goes in 2018. Another thing we're going to be looking at is midterm elections here. Mm. And I want to talk, we talked earlier in the programme about divisions within the Republican Party. Stephen Bannon, good friend of yours,
yeah,
building a coalition, he says, to battle Republican incumbents seeking re-election. That's a Trump-inspired schism in the party, isn't it?
Well, all parties have their divisions. All parties have their wings. Come on, look, let's be honest. I mean, the sort of Mitch McConnell wing of the Republican Party isn't particularly conservative in any way at all. Loathes Trump. And Steve Bannon, who, is a very effective, very bright political operator, he wants to help the president.
But that suggests brutal months ahead for the Republicans, internally.
Could be. I mean, what a bizarre situation it's been. And you've said this earlier, that you have a president in office with majorities in both houses here in Washington. And yet, up until the tax reform, it's been impossible to get anything through. So, yeah, no, I do think that the Republican Party is going to have to do a lot of navel-gazing and soul-searching over the course of 2018.
So you do chug quite a way down the Trump tracks. We found a couple of areas of discomfort for you. When President Trump comes to London, will you be at the airport to welcome him? Is he going to come on the Nigel Farage show?
Well, you never know. I will certainly ask him of that, there's no doubt. Look, I do you know something? The fact that Trump has not yet been to the one country in the world for which he has such a deep affection, which he does, and that's genuine, it's absolutely there, and, I know that. I never disclose any details of conversations I have with him, but I can tell you that through his mum, mm-hmm, his Scottish roots, Ayrshire, his golf courses, his great respect for the British royal family, and that is absolutely sincere and genuine. The fact that the one country that he loves outside of America hasn't deemed fit to invite him on a state visit.
I've invited him.
Well, yeah, but it's all been very downgraded. I think, and he would never say so himself. Even he wouldn't say so himself. But I think it must be a big disappointment to him.
Well, Nigel Farage, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a great Christmas. I will see you, no doubt, in the new year.
Oh, I'll be back. And there's a lot going to happen here next year.
Absolutely. I mentioned that Nigel travels a lot. I've been travelling a lot this year. And after the break, I'll tell you what you're not allowed to take through any airport in China. And here's a clue. Unless you own one, I bet you can't guess. Stay with us.
This is LBC, leading Britain's conversation at Christmas. Christmas on LBC, Trump's first year with Simon Marks.
We're back from Washington on LBC, and it's time to wrap up our special programme from the US Capitol. I told you before the break that I've been doing a lot of travelling this year, and I spent quite a bit of time in China. And every time I pass through the airport in Beijing, there's a huge poster telling travellers what they can't bring on an aeroplane. Obviously, guns, ammunition, hand grenades, dangerous chemicals, and all of that stuff. But I am always bemused to see that tucked away in the middle of the list is a crystal ball. Now, I have no idea why anyone would need to bring a crystal ball onto an aircraft. And presumably, if you've got one and you don't already know it's banned from the aeroplane, then it can't be much of a crystal ball in the first place. But anyway, we are going to gaze into ours. I am joined by the Brits, or at least two of the Brits who cover events here in Washington on an ongoing basis. With me, David Rennie of The Economist and Robert Moore from ITV News. And thank you both very much for joining me. David, as we've rattled through the last 2 hours, we have barely heard from a Democrat. There is no leader of the opposition in this country, of course, but it has seemed that in 2017, the Democrats are a bit leaderless and rudderless, still licking their wounds from last year's election. How are they going to fare in 2018?
Well, 2018 will tell us two things about the future of the Democratic Party. One is obviously there's some big elections at the end of the year, which will decide who controls Congress. And in this strange moment that we live in, everyone understands that that question, who controls Congress, is also the question, will Donald Trump be impeached next year? Because if Democrats take control of Congress, then about 5 minutes after swearing in the new Democratic majority, they will impeach Donald Trump. So that's the stakes. That's understood in the White House. People have told Donald Trump to his face that that is what's at stake. But there's also going to be an awful lot of activity looking to 2020 and the next presidential election. And you can already see a long, long list of people, all of whom figure that they are the answer to the question, what's the opposite of Donald Trump? Because it's a reasonable bet that the opposite of Donald Trump is not a bad thing to be at the next presidential election. And so you're going to see a giant pre-kind of contest already as early as next year underway.
Robert, in the midterm elections, a Republican drubbing and then the possibility of the impeachment of the president?
Well, David is confident that 5 minutes after a Democratic victory in the midterm elections, there'll be an impeachment. Of course, there is the kind of more cynical view, actually, Donald Trump staying in the White House is a more palatable opposition to run against in 2020. And, you know, the fact that there is a crisis in the Democratic Party is very clear from the fact that if you look at the two front runners, you could say it's maybe Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, both elderly statesmen of the Democratic Party. But the fact that there is that sort of generational crisis in the party, I think, suggests that we can take nothing for granted going into 2018.
Is Hillary Clinton going to run again?
Well, no, I think her time is done. Of course, she was her humiliation is deep. She's wounded. And I think her desire, her appetite for further politics is very, very close to zero.
David, there's a temptation to say that the president, with all the difficulties that he's had with members of his own Republican Party on Capitol Hill during 2017, can't get stuff done. But in some areas, the environment, the reduced role that the State Department plays, the coarsening of the discourse here, he's actually changed the country.
Well, here's the fascinating thing. I mean, we all spent a lot of time on the campaign trail. You know, Robert and I were at Trump rallies throughout the kind of the election period, and we heard him saying two kind of big things. One was he had these gigantic promises to bring back the factory jobs and all these populist kind of things he was going to do, and he was going to drain the swamp and kind of completely changed the way Washington works. Well, he hasn't delivered all those kind of millions of factory jobs back. And actually, the things that he's achieved, instead of draining the swamp, he has achieved quite a lot. You're right, Simon. But they've all been kind of swamp ink productions. You know, you do the checklist of the things he has actually achieved. Gigantic tax cuts, basically written by the Republicans in Congress. He appointed a very conservative new Supreme Court justice. It's the first thing any Republican mentions if you ask them, what has Trump done? But that was delivered to him on a silver tray by Republican leaders in Congress, the very people he says he despises. So actually, the only things he's really got done are a kind of wish list of pro-business, elite establishment Republicans in Washington. His stuff, the stuff Robert and I watched him saying on campaign platforms, he hasn't delivered. There's no wall. There's no millions of jobs back.
Mm. And you talk about, Simon, you talk about, you know, droning the swamp and that whole concept that he campaigned on. I mean, I was spending some time a couple of nights ago with some Republican donors and lobbyists, and they were absolutely giddy with success. I mean, they could not believe. This was like a bonanza for them. They had never had a more exhilarating few months than they had on Capitol Hill over the last 8 weeks. Admit, you know, just completely driving and shaping this tax bill. I mean, this was the absolute kind of definition of what Trump had meant on the campaign trail by describing Washington as a swamp. This swamp is deeper now than I've ever seen it.
And let me ask you, Robert, about some of the stories you've covered this year, because you've obviously seen and reported some astonishing things in 2017. Your coverage of Hurricane Harvey comes to mind. You know, obviously, we all reported the Las Vegas shootings and the fallout from them. And then the Harvey Weinstein scandal, which, of course, has created not just ripples, but massive waves throughout American society. What happens specifically about that in 2018? More fallout, criminal trials? Are we going to see Kevin Spacey and Harvey Weinstein and others in the dock? Is there more to come?
Yes, yeah, certainly there's more to come. I mean, look, anybody working in pretty much any high profile sort of ego-driven industry in America is very conscious that what we're looking at so far is the tip of the iceberg. You know, men with power misbehaving in the work environment is prevalent. It reaches every corner of corporate America, every newsroom in America, every political party in America. So sure, there are going to be consequences and sort of cascading fallout from this throughout 2018, undoubtedly.
And David, any political consequences for Donald Trump, given that there are women out there who have made allegations about his behaviour, each one of whom has been called a liar by the White House?
For the moment, there doesn't seem to be any kind of danger for him. I mean, this is the remarkable thing, is defenders of Donald Trump have a point when they say they're being cynical, but they have a point. They say it's not as if the voters didn't know this when they went into the polling booths in November 2016. I mean, there can be no doubt, if you're worried about Donald Trump being a sexual harasser, he's on tape talking about harassing women sexually. The remarkable thing, there was a pretty depressing poll. The Economist does a poll with YouGov. And last week we asked a question about, did people believe Donald Trump when he said it wasn't his voice on the tape that came up during the election, the Access Hollywood tape where he talked about grabbing women? And Donald Trump has recently started saying that wasn't his voice. Now, half of Republicans agree with him that that wasn't his voice, even though he admitted during the election that it was his voice. So now it's really that kind of moment from Orwell, from 1984, where the numbers swim in front of your eyes and you find yourself believing that two and two do not make four.
And of course, that does kind of talk to one of the great successes of the Trump presidency. You know, we talk about whether it's a consequential first year. And one of the great sort of successes from his perspective is he has sown doubt, skepticism about, you know, mainstream reporting and news journalism. And so one of the great successes of 2017 from the perspective of the White House is to have successfully planted the seed of fake news. And now even quite mainstream Republican voters will doubt what otherwise was conventional, you know, news reporting. And it's very worrying.
And as we end the year, let me raise a pet foible, which is an issue that I just don't understand about the Trump White House. This country lost a lot of talent during 2017. Mary Tyler Moore, Tom Petty, Chuck Berry, David Cassidy, Don Rickles, Jonathan Demme. The list goes on and on and on. And you hardly ever see a statement of tribute from this president, as you've always seen from presidents past, to Americans who have made significant contributions to public life here. Why not?
Well, if you're waiting for Donald Trump to be magnanimous and to say, goodness me, I'm now president of the world's most powerful country, I'm going to be generous-spirited and not want to hog the headlines, I think we've been waiting for that to happen. It hasn't happened yet, and it's never going to happen.
Bizarre, isn't it?
Bizarre, yeah. I mean, look, we expected at every stage of this, of following the trajectory of Donald Trump, for the presidential pivot. And, you know, 1 year on, as David makes quite rightly clear, there is no pivot, there will be no pivot. We have the man in the White House who we know is Donald Trump. He's not going to be magnanimous. He's not going to be a conventional president in any sense of that word.
Well, it's going to be an interesting 2018. I hope you both get a good Christmas rest. David Rennie of The Economist, Robert Moore of ITN, or as they insist on calling it now, ITV News. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And finally, some thoughts for those of you who often get in touch on Twitter and tell me that I am relentlessly anti-Donald Trump. I hope the last 2 hours have demonstrated the complexities of that roller coaster ride that we're on here in Washington. The Trump presidency is not like any of its predecessors, and there are things that happen here that are so unprecedented, so outrageous, so threatening to the constitutional checks and balances that have prevented authoritarians from coming to power in the US for more than 200 years, that it would be absolutely remiss if we didn't report on them and also objectively point out how unusual they are. As a candidate, Donald Trump ripped up the rulebook of American elections. It was a remarkable achievement. Now he's trying to tear up the presidential rulebook. But the problem he continues to face is that that book, the American Constitution, is more than a written document. It's living, it's breathing, it does constrain what any president can do. It has faced tests before, and it's always come through unscathed. Will it this time? Whatever happens as I go into my 25th year in Washington, I'll keep you completely up to date right here on LBC. This has been Trump's first year. My producer was Christian Mitchell in London. I'm Simon Marks. For now, goodbye from Washington.
This is LBC, leading Britain's conversation at Christmas.